Okay, we're doing this. Good. Here. There. There. Okay, we got it. We're on. All right. Hi. How are you? I'm very fine, thank you very much. Okay, housekeeping questions first. Okay, your houses are all well kept. Okay. I guess. No problems. And sometimes I feel unneeded. If you have no problems. And then I have to find things for Julie to do. If you don't have problems. All right. They just want to go right on to the content. That's what you just did. We'll take them after. You haven't turned them in yet. What did you discover doing that exercise? What problems came up? What questions came up? Yes. Okay. Examples that you came up with?
I was thinking of driving.
Driving.
For me. Okay. As one of those, and like, reading, writing, but then I think that, that is totally molecular. I don't even have to think about that anymore.
Yeah, that's when you start having accidents, when you stop thinking about it. But did you think of a way to turn the concept of driving or the activity of driving into a molar activity? Have you incorporated it into other things that you do?
I did, like if I was on a road trip and somebody else driving somebody else's car,
right.
Paying attention to where I'm going and also getting used to driving to get the car.
Right. Okay. Good example. So things that you concentrate on for a while, but then they become second nature, they become easy. As I said on Wednesday, if you change the circumstances, they may become molar again. Switch from an automatic to a stick shift. Switch from an automobile to an 18-wheeler. Switch from an 18-wheeler to a bulldozer. And it becomes a molar activity again. And in the case of doing it in the same kind of vehicle, it gets incorporated into a larger activity. So it gets subsumed under a more complex activity such as a road trip. And the driving part of it is an important part of it, but then you also have to plan the financing, the navigation, the route that you're going, where you're going to stay, when you're going to start, how long it's going to take you. Some destination maybe, although some road trips don't have that. Snacks, trash bag for the car, pillow, all of those things, companions. All of those become part of the larger activity that the driving gets incorporated into. Okay. Other questions or observations that came up as you were doing this? Yeah. Did you know that walking could be that complicated?
No.
No. Have you started tripping over things now because you're paying so much attention?
No.
No? Not yet. Not yet. That's the third week of that course. Okay. That's a nice example because you learned to walk. It was a molar activity when you were learning it, and then you just kind of do it, and then you've taken this course that's made it part of a more complex activity, which is moving for fitness. Yeah. Molar activities, walking can become a molar activity again if something happens to disrupt it. My personal example was hurting my knee and having to be real careful this fall about how I walked so that I wasn't aggravating it and having to pay attention to it again and being conscious of which ways I went upstairs or downstairs or how I stepped off curbs. It's almost better now. Yeah? Anything else come up? Yes. Proximal processes, yes. We will get there, but just to answer your question briefly, Bronfenbrenner makes a distinction, and it's not unique to him, and he didn't make it up. People have tried to tried to grasp the difference among kinds of influences. And when you work on the kind of scale that Bronfenbrenner uses, when he's talking about all of the possible influences on your development, from the historical time that you live in, to the political system that affects you, to the opportunities that are open to you, you know, all of those things that are affecting you, Bronfenbrenner and others make the distinction between kinds of processes that affect you, and he focuses on the proximal processes, which means the root is proximity, nearness. And he's referring to the kinds of processes that you actually engage in, what you actually do. And it's connected to activities because it's the molar activities that you are engaging in that make up some of the proximal processes. So he's talking about the direct influence of your own engagement in activities, in relationships, in the setting, in learning. And saying that in order to account for your development, we have to pay attention to what you are actually doing. It's not adequate. It may be important, but it's not sufficient or adequate to say that you grew up in a low-income home. Because that doesn't tell us anything specific about what you actually did. And he distinguishes those, as do other people, from distal processes. Distal from distant. Things that are more removed. Things that you're not actively, directly engaged in yourself. So the political process that's going on in the country may influence your teachers, your parents, the opportunities you have, but those are not proximal. They're not activities that you are actually directly engaged in. They're not engaging you directly. The political process is a distal process. It may be very important, but it is not something from which you are constructing your understanding of your life and your world. You're not constructing skills from that. It may be influencing the opportunities you have for engaging in proximal processes. Thank you. So the distinction is between the proximal and the distal, and the proximal are anything that you're directly engaged in or that you're being impinged by right now. Okay. Anything else that came up in doing the exercise or in reading? I'll go back and pick up some aspects of molar activities now. Okay. All right. We'll read those and Julie will have them back to you by the end of the hour. No. No. Next week? Next week. Okay. Next week. Okay. Quick review. We were talking about molar activities, ongoing behaviors. Presumably you found ongoing behaviors. You were able to describe momentum and the meaning or intent. And at the end of the hour on Wednesday, I was talking about the use that Bronfenbrenner makes of the notion of molar activities. If you're engaging in molar activities, those molar activities get constructed into bigger molar activities in the process that they become molecular, but your focus then becomes the bigger, more complex activity. And Bronfenbrenner thinks that activity is so important that he suggests we can use it as an index of your maturity, your developmental status, how well developed you are, he argues, will be reflected in the nature of the molar activities that you engage in. More mature people, he says, have a bigger repertoire of molar activities that they engage in, and the molar activities that they engage in are more complex. And they're more varied. You don't just do the same thing over and over again. You have a variety, if you're well developed. You have a variety of things that you can engage in. And presumably then, what you see across the course of development, from infancy to into adulthood, is that the things that you do become more complex, and there are more of them, more variety. And then he throws in the added little piece that if we really wanted to assess how mature you are, we would look at what you do when nobody's telling you what to do. You might be able to do very complex things when somebody else is telling you to do them. But when he's talking about maturity, he's interested in what you do on your own. If nobody's telling you what to do, you sit on the couch and surf the channels, or do you do something interesting, useful? Do you go out and get more information? Do you learn things? Do you practice? Or do you just work on your thumb skills? Question?
What maturity? How would you define that?
How would you define maturity? Well, Bronfenbrenner would say, let's look at the complexity and variety of your molar activities. That's what this is getting him. He can finesse that question. The question is, how would you define maturity? How would you define maturity? He's arguing that if you really are interested in how mature somebody is, then you need to take a stand on what that means. And maturity is not defined by chronological age. That tells you how many times the earth has gone around the sun. Then it doesn't tell you anything about proximal processes or what the person can actually do. Some people at 21 are pretty immature and other people are very, very mature. Why do we say they're mature? We use words like responsible. Organized, savvy, motivated. Bronfenbrenner says, put those together and look at the outcomes. Look at what the person does, the complexity of those activities and the variety of those activities on his or her own. It's a very interesting answer to the question of what do you mean by maturity? Maturity is, by that kind of definition, always relative. Now, somebody's less mature, somebody's more mature. It's a process of going from immature to more mature. And how do we know that's happening? For Bronfenbrenner, we know it's happening because the molar activities the person engages in are becoming more complex or more diverse. Maturity is not measured by IQ. There are a couple of tests that you can take for social maturity. One is used for intellectually challenged children. It's called the Vineland Social Maturity Scale. And it would be interesting if you'll remind me, Julie, to look up a copy of that. Because my memory of it, having studied it the last time someplace in graduate school, about 1966, it's probably the last time I used it. It's still used. I see it advertised once in a while. My recall of it is that it asks about the activities that you can engage in, how complex your peer relationships are, since it's social maturity, how responsible you are, can you engage in a conversation, and what can you do on your own when nobody is directing you? What do you do when left to your own devices? And you get points on that scale. It's, I don't know, 50 items or so of things that you would expect children potentially to be able to do. And if they, each one that you can do, you get a point or two. I've forgotten how it's scaled. And then the more points you get, the more socially mature you are. But I think that fits very nicely with Bronfenbrenner's suggestion here, because I think it's actually a measure of the complexity of the activities, particularly social, molar activities that you engage in on your own. How else would you define maturity? Okay, the suggestion is it might be defined by the role you play in other people's lives.
Kind of, your maturity level might be lower depending on who you're associating with at the time, like your parents, or if you have a little brother or sister, if you were different people at different times, your maturity level might be greater or lower.
Okay, that's an interesting notion to chase. One of the suggestions you just made is that the context that you're in might shape how complex your molar activities are or not. Some of you take pretty good care of yourself when you're here, and then you go home and you let somebody else prepare meals for you and do your laundry, and that's one of the reasons we go home, right? So we can drop our molar activities a little. But if, for example, two siblings came home at the same time and one of them pitches in and helps with meals and is interested in talking to other people and encouraging them and finding out what's going on in their lives, and the other one doesn't, then you would say that the one who does those things is more mature. Okay, so there are roles that you play and activities that you engage in, ways you relate to other people that might contribute to the sense that you were more mature. I can go ahead. Okay, so thinking about, if I understand your comment, that the way you interact with other people, showing empathy, taking responsibility for communicating your own needs, expressing your wants and desires appropriately and being able to listen and take into account other people's. Those would be characteristics of interpersonal maturity or emotional maturity. And I guess they would fit in molar activities. We could force them in there as molar activities, but they're really, I think you've pushed us more over into the realm of the nature of our relationships with other people rather than what we do on our own. And that's the way my mind was going when I asked the question. So I'm glad to have that from somebody else, because I was wondering if I was going off on a tangent. I think there are other ways to define maturity. And as I read this, I'm not sure that he's trying to define maturity. And as I read it, I'm sure he's not saying molar activities are the only evidence we have of maturity. What he's saying is that your maturity is reflected in, okay, that there's a correlation, that there's a congruence between your maturity and what you do on your own, the complexity and variety of your molar activities. So I think he's stepping around the question of how do you define it. He's just saying there's a relationship here. And we might define it in more precise ways. We might define social maturity compared to whatever other adjective you want. He's saying that we should be able to see, if we're going to call somebody mature, we should be able to see that reflected in their molar activities. And good question. Good question and good comments. Who comes to mind? What came to mind for me, the comment was, how does that apply to somebody who might be unable physically to engage in complex molar activities? What immediately came to mind for me was Stephen Hawking, the physicist. The kinds of molar activities that he engages in on his own, writing books in his head, leave no doubt in my mind that he's incredibly mature and incredibly sophisticated thinker. I wish I could even comprehend what he thinks about Hawking, Einstein. There are a few of those whose mental molar activities were extremely complex. I'm sorry, I'm not.
I'm having a question definition about how people develop in their own world. So everyone starts off at different places, so that kind of accounts for people's expression and like that.
Let me digest that. The comment is that Bronfenbrenner is talking about people in their own ecosystem, in their own world. And clearly the opportunities you have to practice, the encouragement you have to practice particular molar activities would depend on that ecosystem. Developmentally, we would be looking for the complexity and variety to increase, and that would perhaps be shaped by the ecosystem that you were in. Did I capture the pieces of it? Okay, I want to take that notion and expand it, looking at how Bronfenbrenner then takes this notion of developmental status or maturity. I don't want us to get hung up on how we define maturity, but I think it's an important issue. And I think he's not trying to define it, but he's calling our attention to the relationship between whatever our notions of maturity are and the nature of the molar activities that we engage in. When he begins to apply that, then and you might recall that I said that he was one of the founders of the Head Start program, and he was involved in evaluations of Head Start. One of the ways he applied that proposition was in this hypothesis when he brought it into his framework. He said, if we want to look at the consequences of a program like Head Start, and he's sitting around a table, I can visualize this, he's sitting around a table with psychologists who want to give everybody IQ scores or achievement tests, and Bronfenbrenner very wisely is saying, we probably should not evaluate a program based on whether it increases IQ, since we don't have a clue what IQ tests measure, or what they predict other than success in school. We probably don't want to kill this program on the basis of achievement tests, although that was tried later. And the fact that it didn't improve IQ scores significantly over time, the IQ score increases resulting from Head Start diminished as kids got into elementary school. But people suggested that we use that to evaluate and kill the program. He said, let's look at the complexity of the things that they actually do. Let's look at the molar activities. Let's look at his social relations. And between the lines here, it's helpful to remember that Head Start was created because children were having difficulty when they went into regular classrooms. Poor children. Children from low socioeconomic family backgrounds. I remember that's a social address rather than a description of proximal processes. The program was designed to give kids experiences that would prepare them for being comfortably and therefore successfully in elementary school classrooms. And what he's arguing is, let's look at that. If that's what we're after, so the kids can actually engage in the proximal processes that are going to go on in kindergarten and first grade, then let's actually look at that to see if they're doing that. And then long term, if they can, it should show up in their school success. Not necessarily their IQ scores, not necessarily their achievement tests, but their ability to be in school, to benefit from school, and to continue to develop. Question? The comment is that it's amazing to see what kids can do if you encourage them to do it and create a setting in which they will do it. And some of us grow up in settings where we don't clean up after ourselves because nobody ever teaches us to or expects us to. But if you're dealing with 15 or 20 kids in a classroom, in a group setting, you will either do all of those things yourself as the teacher, or you will help the children learn to do them. And in Montessori-based classrooms and Waldorf classrooms and Head Start programs that are working well, one of the things that you do to survive as a teacher and to help the kids develop is to teach them how to do the skills. Remember the description of the definition of development. To engage in the activities that will help them maintain their environment and explore it and improve it. And cleaning up after yourself and sharing and putting toys away and getting yourself dressed, all of those things are activities that will help you in the environment. And if you can do all of those things as a result of having been in an early childhood setting, then going into school, where you're expected to do those things, is going to be easier. And we'll come back to that again. Okay. So Bronfenbrenner is telling us that we need to look at the actual activities, pay attention to what they are, and in an early childhood program, for example, to pay attention to them and to actually use what the kids can do if we want to evaluate the program. What the kids can do, not their IQ scores, not their achievement tests, not their GPAs. There's another association that I always have when I think about test scores not predicting much of anything. One of my college classmates who lived in the next entry from me was a member of Terman's gifted children study. And he was very aware that his IQ was over 170. And he was kind of embarrassed by that, having been in the study of gifted children. And I was puzzled. Through our entire 4 years in college together, by two things. One is that he never seemed to know what to do. Weekends, he just didn't know what to do. And he carried a C-minus average through college. In part because he never knew what to do. He was sitting there, I used to have a picture of him kind of being overawed by his IQ rather than figuring out how the world works or what to do. Nobody had been able to engage him in the proximal processes that would help him figure out how to organize his time, get his work done, remember where his socks were, things of that sort. And he was not the only college acquaintance I had who had that problem. Okay, how do we get there? Let's move to hypotheses. This is number one. Bronfenbrenner is going to hypothesize that some of us become engaged in complex activities and a variety of activities because we are around other people who are engaged in complex and varied activities. Now he's getting to the nub of the matter. What is important, he says, what may be important, is to be around people who are engaged in complex activities. Maybe parents, maybe siblings, maybe teachers, maybe classmates. He's saying that if a person develops complex and varied activities, it's likely that we will find other people who engage in complex and varied activities in the person's near ecosystem. And probably they will be engaged in activities with the person who is engaging, who is developing those more complex activities. So now we have the social context. If you are responsible for the development of a person, then it might be helpful to think about the activities the person is engaging in. And it may be important that you engage in those activities with the person. So if I'm going to teach somebody to play the piano, it might be helpful if I play the piano with the person. If I'm going to motivate somebody to get better playing music, perhaps it would be helpful if I know a little something about music myself and engage the person I'm interested in influencing in participating in activities that are musical with me. And that's a practical application of that hypothesis. Ah, there is an interesting connection. The observation is that if you begin to do something that you do with somebody who doesn't know how to do them, or with somebody who doesn't do them as well as you do, you may be making them molar again for yourself. And by engaging in those activities with the other person, you're making them potentially molar activities for that person. The person who's learning. The person Bronfenbrenner calls the developing person. The person who is less developed, the person we're focusing on. So if I begin to engage in the activities with the person, then they may become molar activities for that person. The person who's learning them. And I may look at them in a different way. And that's what I really responded to in your comment, is that as I begin to engage in activities that I'm comfortable and familiar with somebody who is less well-developed and doesn't understand those activities, I look at them differently, and that process may make them molar. So sharing the activity, participating in it jointly with somebody who doesn't do as well, may make me pay attention to it and make it molar again. That's a very interesting observation.
I completely agree with them because I tried to teach my brother how to play the piano and he doesn't know anything about it. And I was like, well, let me teach you, some scales or whatever. And you just don't remember how you know them. And I do this so fast. And I was trying to just go with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sharing them with somebody else and trying to teach that person requires you to understand them in a different way. Kind of like walking for physical fitness. Once you start doing that with somebody else and paying attention to it, you become self-conscious about it. But in that process, you're understanding the activity in a different way. And it's an old cliche, and I think it's true, that one of the ways to improve your understanding of almost anything that you know is to try to teach somebody else. I could read Bronfenbrenner, use Bronfenbrenner, but I have learned far more about his system and what it means and how to use it from trying to teach it than I ever would have learned on my own. The process of trying to teach your understanding makes you focus on it differently, makes you think about it from a different perspective, the perspective of somebody who's trying to understand it. And that's why teaching is so challenging, because it's a very different activity than just doing something. Figuring out how other people learn it is very complex. Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, let's look at very quickly a more complex way that Bronfenbrenner and Morris bring together the notion of activities. For development to occur, the person must engage in an activity. Whoa, boy, there's a strong statement. Okay. Take that statement apart. Number one, it says that unless you're engaging in activity, you're not going to develop. A pure constructivist Piagetian notion. No activity, no development. The constructivist notion. We construct our understanding, which underlies our development, through our activity. To be effective, the activity must take place on a fairly regular basis over an extended period of time. So once doesn't do it. This means that in the case of young children, a weekend of doing things with mom or dad doesn't do the job, nor do activities that are often interrupted. So it needs to be an ongoing activity. Remember, molar is ongoing activity. On a fairly regular basis over an extended period of time. So showing your brother how to play scales once is not going to turn him into a pianist. Practice. Practice. And why won't one-shot activities work? They must continue long enough to become increasingly more complex. Mere repetition doesn't work. The activity needs to become more complex for development to take place. This is in the book, by the way. I hope you're not copying it down. It's in the book. Developmentally effective proximal processes are not unidirectional. There must be influence in both directions. In the case of interpersonal interaction, this means that initiatives do not come from one side only. There must be some degree of reciprocity in the exchange. So, if you're trying to teach your brother to play the piano, directing it all the time is probably not going to make it work. Telling him what to do over and over again isn't going to make it work. Getting him to practice, getting him to explore, getting him to, and allowing him to ask questions, to vary the activity, to explore it, to play around, to experiment, having some control and input into the activity is, for Bronfenbrenner, likely to be necessary. And then to expand on the notion of proximal processes, they're not limited to interactions with people. They can also involve interaction with objects and symbols, reading, playing with blocks, magnetiles, all of the manipulables that you enjoy, a deck of cards. And in those cases, the objects and the symbols have to be such that they invite attention. They invite exploration and manipulation. In other words, it has to be something that you can do with it, that you can vary. And a piano is a wonderful example. The piano gives you typically 88 keys, and they're organized in a particular way, but there's an infinite variety of ways you can strike them, put them together, patterns, we call it music, or they produce music. A deck of cards, you could probably build a whole curriculum on. Deck of cards is really cool if you think about it. What can you do with the deck of cards other than play 52 card pickup, which is, you know, every two-year-old's. It's good for motor skills. You know, you want to play cards with the kid. The kid says, "Oh, let's play 52 card pickup," and you pick them up, and that's cool. But then you get to arrange them. Ah, they're not square, you know. They're rectangular. This is interesting. They're not the same on both sides. You can organize them. They have numbers. 1 through 10. Sorry, it's been a long time since I played the deck of cards. And then it's got people. Oh, that's complex too. Jack, Queen, King. An odd sort of thing that the deck of cards goes round. The ace is also one. But it's either the lowest or the highest. They come in two colors, red and black. Four suits. They're really sweets, but suits, okay. Hearts, clubs, diamonds, spades, they're different. So you can take the 52 cards and you can lay them out by rank, one through king. You can organize them into four suits. You can make a 4x13 matrix, all the twos, each suit. Wow, that gets much more complex, right? Okay. You can do the same thing with unit blocks, you can do the same thing with tin cans, broken glass, whatever else you have to play with, you can make it more complex. And if you have a curious, bizarre, warped mind, you can explore, manipulate, create, recombine in new ways, whatever the materials are. Those are proximal processes. The recombination, the exploration, the experimentation, that's proximal process. Materials that invite that, that allow that, that encourage that, are ones that are likely to engage you in activities that are going to cause development. Okay. Coming back to, for development to occur, the person must engage in an activity with people and or with materials that have complexity implicit in the way they are made. Okay? Activities. Have we talked activities to death? Probably. Yeah, probably means that you're not going to develop very much if somebody is telling you what to do and you don't particularly want to do it and you don't have any influence on how you do it. He's probably going to argue that you're likely to stop paying attention, get bored, and eventually rebel if you're an average boy and bail out, right? How many of you started piano lessons at some point and quit? How many of you were fired? Am I the only one who was fired from piano lessons? Okay. The first time I stopped because I had the opportunity to play trombone is we moved to a different town and they had a band, so I took up trombone. But in high school, I looked at those ads that said, you can learn. They laughed when I sat down. You've read those ads, right? I wanted to learn the piano. So I voluntarily, paying for them out of my own pocket, started piano lessons in high school. Voluntarily. My own initiative. And I would have stuck with it, too. But I came in one day and I performed the exercise that I'd been working on. And Mrs. Carrico said, you know, I give voice lessons too. It was very subtle. And then she explained, your left hand and your right hand aren't talking to each other. And she had me do a series of exercises to try to coordinate my left hand and my right hand. So I took voice lessons. Voluntarily. Okay. Now, that preceding overhead talked about the importance of activities with other people. Hypothesis one suggested that the complexity and variety of the molar activities that you engage in is a function of, or varies with, the variety and complexity of the molar activities that the people around you engage in. Okay, so we have a couple of notions here that other people are important. How are we going to think about other people? Aha! We have relations. Relations are important. Other people are important. If we're going to look at your ecosystem, if we're going to study families, other people are going to be important, right? That's what it's about. No man is an island unto himself, however the rest of that goes. And none of us lives completely outside a set of relationships, and we're going to have to look at that. So how do we think about them? Well, there's a relation whenever one person in a setting pays attention to or participates in the activities of another. We are engaged in relationships with each other. We're in a setting. You are, for the most part, paying attention, and I'm paying attention to you, and we are occasionally engaging in an activity together. I ask you questions, you ask me questions, we have a back and forth. Therefore, we have relations. A dyad is formed whenever two persons pay attention to or participate in one another's activities. Okay. So, what Bronfenbrenner is going to be talking about, what we're going to be talking about, is dyadic relations. A dyadic relationship is a relationship between two people. Dyad from two. Where are you by yourself? In that language. You know? All by yourself, you are a monad. One person, no relation. But if you put two people together and they're paying attention to each other, then you have a dyad. You have a relation, you have a dyad. We could study triads or quatrads or quintads or octets or duodecahedron octets, whatever's, I don't know, there's a word for a group of 13, I just don't remember it. Okay? So, but we're going to look at the simplest kind of relation, which is two people. And then we'll expand that to look at triads. But trying to understand fours, fives, sixes, octets, chamber ensembles, and full orchestras is too complex. Psychologists begin to go nuts when they start trying to capture the relationships among large groups of people. It's just simply too much to pay attention to, too much information. So we're going to talk about different kinds of dyads, and then I'll promise that we'll talk about triads and quatrads, but we'll never get there. Okay, but just apply what you know about dyads, what you learn about dyads, and extend it until your mind boggles, and I will avoid talking about quatrads and quintads forever. It makes my mind hurt. There are three kinds of dyads, three functional forms. And actually we're going to talk about four, but Bronfenbrenner starts with three. The first is an observational dyad. That happens when one person is paying attention to the activity of the other, who at least acknowledges being observed. So, for the most part, there are in here 120 or so, that's average attendance, observational dyads in which I participate. I hope you're watching. You're observing me. You're trying to, what is this guy? How did he get this way? You are observing. I am acknowledging that you're observing me. We are, each of you and me, engaged in an observational dyad. Some of you are occasionally engaged in the room is not built to encourage you to engage in observational dyads with each other, because mostly you can only see the back of somebody else's head. Right? Remember that when we get to proposition F, the nature of the setting, the physical setting, determines what can go on in it. This observational dyad, the one that you each have with me, is encouraged by the arrangement of this room. It's not designed to encourage you to have observational dyadic relations with each other, because you're looking at somebody's head or you're sitting in the front and you can't see anybody else at all. But sometimes you turn, sometimes you look. Sometimes, like, there are a couple of you who are trying to make eye contact across the room, and I think you're both single and I think you're both interested, and so get together. Okay. That's what flirting is about, observational dyadic relationships, right? You observe, you acknowledge the observation, it stays observational until you begin to recognize that you're both flirting with each other. Okay. Then it is a joint activity dyad. The activity is flirting. And you perceive yourself as doing it together. Studying together. Eating lunch together. Having a cup of coffee together. Making love together. Those are joint activity dyads. So anytime two people are engaging in an activity that they think they're doing together, then you have a joint activity dyad. And the third functional kind, the third kind defined by what's going on in it, is a primary dyad, which for Bronfenbrenner is one that is important. It means a friendship. It means a parent-child. It means two people who are important to each other. And one of the ways that we know it's a primary dyad is that they think about each other even when they're not together. So a primary dyad is the one that you bring into the class when you bring your best friend, your roommate, your brother, your sister, whoever you're with, who is somebody you know and probably know well and think about. And some of you who are engaging in observational dyads and hope they turn into joint activity dyads will hope by mid-semester that they become primary dyads, that you actually think about each other and you're studying together and you're calling each other up and saying, I didn't see you in class today, where were you? I was thinking about you, we're in a primary dyadic relationship, let's make it joint activity this evening. Okay? Okay? Now, what that suggests is that the forms, observational, joint activity, and primary, flow one into the other. And Bronfenbrenner has hypotheses that suggest exactly that. If you're in an observational dyad, once you recognize and acknowledge that it's an observational dyad, then it's likely, not necessary, but it's likely to become a joint activity dyad. The flirting is an example, it's a nice example of that, because there you are observing each other, it's an observational dyad. But once you acknowledge that to each other, even non-verbally, once the eye contact becomes regular, once the facial expressions begin to indicate interest and pleasure in this observation, then you're engaging in a joint activity of flirting. If the flirting goes far enough, then you increase the jointness of the act. the complexity of the activities. You become more active. That's where I'm trying to get with that. And you decide to have coffee together, you have lunch together, you study together. So the joint activities in the dyad become more complex. And if you do that long enough, then you begin to think about the other person even when you're not together. Okay. So the observational dyad tends to become joint activity. Not essential, but it may. Joint activity dyads carried over in time tend to become primary. Okay. So, take it to a different setting. You go to the tennis court and you watch somebody playing and you're there and your partner, the person you were going to play tennis with, didn't show up, so you observe somebody who's pretty good and looks like might be interesting to play with. So you observe, that person acknowledges the end of their set, you say, you want to play some more? My partner didn't show up. You turn it into a joint activity dyad. It's a pretty good match. You enjoy playing with each other. You enjoy the tennis. And so you exchange names and phone numbers. So the next time you don't have somebody to play tennis with, you call the person. You make a tennis date. Okay. So you think about that person when you're not together. And over time, it may become a friendship. It may be restricted to the tennis court, but it might become something more complex than that. I'm sorry? Not always in the same order, no. There is a logic to the particular order of going. It would be hard to have a primary dyad when you had not had an observation, when you not had a joint activity dyad. It would be hard to do that. So there is a logic to the complexity of the relation that's going on. And I can think of a situation where one person might be thinking of the other a lot, having seen the person in class, having made eye contact, maybe engaged in a little flirting, but that's it. And then you spend a lot of time wondering if the person is going to sit near you next time, and then you start fantasizing about what you might do if you went beyond just class together. And so it's really not a joint activity dyad. It's not a primary dyad unless the other person is doing the same thing at the same time, roughly the same time. It doesn't have to be the same moment. Okay. But normally what you would typically see is that people observe each other and that tends to lead them to engage in activities together. And then if they engage in the activities over time, they tend to create a primary relationship in which they know more about each other, they think more about each other, they plan, and they both do it. So it's mutual. They're both engaged, both parties. It's not just a crush where I'm fantasizing about you, but primary dyad is one where both people see themselves as involved in the relationship. Some of you know about hypothesis one in a practical way. I watched one of my favorite child care givers, and I've seen this several times since, but when my daughter was in middle school, we had friends visit, and she was supposed to take care of the child who was, I guess, about a year old at that point, while the rest of us went and did something else, and the child wanted nothing to do with my daughter, or anybody else for that matter, who wasn't in her immediate family. So my daughter did her usual thing, this is what we recommend generally, is that if you want a one-year-old or two-year-old to warm up to you, you don't do anything. And you certainly don't approach them. So you sit down and you pick up something interesting and you maybe turn your back to the kid that you're trying to create a joint activity dyad with, and you engage in some activity. with yourself. You know, okay, here I am. And the natural curiosity of human beings will bring most kids around to where they can observe you. They want to be in observational dyads. They want to know what bigger people are doing. And then you let the kid watch for a while, and you don't say, "You do it." No, you just let the kid watch. And the kid watches for a while, and the kid gets comfortable with it, and then you surreptitiously kind of invite the kid to play with whatever it is you're playing with, and that's okay. And you do parallel play for a little while, and then the kid will usually turn it into a joint activity. And once you turn it into a joint activity that's kind of interesting, the anxiety level goes down and the kid stops fussing about the fact that you're a stranger. You're not forcing yourself on the child. And then the kid begins to initiate, remember the, "I've got to have some control over this," reciprocity to make it a joint activity that's interesting to me, and as we do that, then I get interested in you, and then you can touch me, and then we can have a relationship that becomes more complex where I'm trusting you because you haven't overwhelmed me with your strangeness, with your newness, with assuming that I'm going to like you. I have control. So the observational dyad becomes a joint activity dyad, and then a half an hour later the kid wants you to give her lunch or whatever is next, and then you've started a friendship. Believing in hypothesis one and hypothesis two, and believing in the natural curiosity of other people, allows you to enter relationships with less anxiety, less hassle, less conflict, if they're actually interested. And 1-year-olds are always interested in everybody, but they need to do it on their own terms. Okay, what I want you to think about is the relations that you are engaged in. Read the text part that you were reading for today about relationships and think about how you would describe the relations that you have. How would you describe important dyads? For Bronfenbrenner, it's important to think about the affect, the power, and the degree of reciprocity. So review those in the text and think about how they apply to dyads that you're in, and we'll see you on Wednesday.